You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Patricia Bosworth, a brilliant writer who gave up acting to write a series of biographies and a pair of powerful memoirs, died on April 2nd in Manhattan. She was 86 and a victim of the coronavirus. She was a guest on this show a few times, and today we remember her by listening back to my 2018 interview, recorded after the publication of her second memoir, The Men in My Life, a memoir of love and art in 1950s Manhattan, a sequel to her 1997 book, Anything Your Little Heart Desires, An American Family Story. We've been corresponding a bit lately because when you were a little girl, your father, Bartley Crum, a prominent Bay Area attorney, bought a little country home in a sleepy beach town in California called Aptos. And the home your father bought, a historic landmark now, is by sheer coincidence about 3 miles from where I live right now. It's kind of odd.
I know.
And right now, although the house is still standing, but it's, you know, there's not a single inch of uncovered space around it with other buildings and malls and housing developments and so forth.
I can't believe it. It's one of the most beautiful memories of my childhood, growing up there with the gardens, the vineyard, not a vineyard, there were apple orchards on the hill, and beautiful rose garden. I noticed the redwoods are still there.
Yeah, that's right.
The redwood trees, but it is sort of unsettling, I must say.
To see it all.
Yeah, to see it, well, it's just totally different. Well, to me, it's ruined. But maybe it isn't. I mean, at least I guess the house is still standing. But I don't know. It's a strange feeling.
I sent you some pictures. So the whole area was just that one house, and then just like acres and acres of land around it.
Oh yeah. I don't know what it's like now. I went back there when I did the Anything Your Little Heart Desires, started researching. I went back then in '98 or something like that, and at that point, they did not have all the houses. They had the little mall, but
right,
they didn't have the funny little houses surrounding our house. So, but it was still totally changed. Well, Aptos isn't it the cute computer capital of the world or something?
Well, not exactly, but yeah, you know, I mean, now they're constantly building here, and there's a whole new onslaught of buildings. I mean, I prefer, you know, have things the way they were, but. Oh, well.
Have you been there a long time? Have you lived there many,
I've lived
many
in
years?
Santa Cruz County since 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was a latecomer. So who am I to complain?
Yes. But, you know, my mother's grandfather helped build the railroad from San Francisco to Santa Cruz. There was once a little railroad.
Yeah. It went right up to the Coconut Grove, I believe.
That's right. Anyway, so my family, both sides, are from California, so I sort of treasure that kind of history of knowing about what went on in those days, which of course are now long gone, to put it mildly. Visually, they are like Santa Cruz. The Santa Cruz, a university branch of the University of California is in Santa Cruz,
yes,
on a hill.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
I used to ride. There was a stables up there, totally, you know, just all landscape. When my brother and I were preteen, we used to ride horseback up there.
Yeah, beautiful.
I mean, it was gorgeous. Anyway, enough on that.
Well, but
life has to go on.
You bring up an interesting point when you talk about how we love history. We're interested in history, and now you've written a lot about other people and about famous people, and yet personal family history is the most fascinating. Your two books are intertwined and they're deeply fascinating to me, and I think to anybody who wants to read them. There was a 20-year gap between the two memoirs. Were you researching? Did you always plan to write a second one?
I really didn't know. I mean, between that, with the time I wrote Anything Your Little Heart Desires and then The Men in My Life, I wrote The Brando and then The Fonda, which took me many years because, you know, her life was so complicated and multi-leveled that actually she lived four lives, really. You know, she was an activist and a movie star and a tycoon's wife, and she's done everything. But anyway, it took me a long time to research it and to write it, so I sort of put my own past in the back burner. Then I suddenly thought maybe this particular period, the one that I write about in The Men of My Life, would be important because it was this 10 crucial years in my life where I seemed to be doing everything, and where everything terrible happened, like the two suicides of my brother and father, coupled with me trying to overcome my grief by becoming a workaholic and becoming a, you know, model and an actress and then writer. So it was, I just suddenly wanted to write about this particular 10-year period because it was so intense.
It's interesting because I'm sure you had no idea that the whole Me Too movement was coming, but it does sort of fit the moment. You must have some feelings about this Me Too thing.
I do. I have very mixed feelings. I think it's overdone, and I think that it's almost, well, McCarthy-ish now, Joseph McCarthy. I mean, I think that men are being accused when they maybe flirt or maybe touch you physically, that they're fired or their careers are destroyed. I think it's overdone. I'm sorry. I mean, I did have a lot of experiences myself, and I think I handle them in my own way. But I think some of it is just, it's too much. I certainly think Harvey Weinstein should be prosecuted, but I'm not sure that senator, Al Franken,
yeah.
I don't know whether he should have resigned. I think he, you know, made a mistake, but I don't know. I feel it's in some cases it's overdone. That's not the right word.
Well, no, I understand what you mean. I mean, there's a fine line between sexual harassment and flirting.
Yeah, there is a fine line, and I think that it's that not enough is delineated. I'm upset. I mean, I'm not upset about, I think Charlie Rose and what's the other guy on NBC?
Matt Lauer.
Matt Lauer, all the ones who really seem to have been pretty awful should definitely be prosecuted. But somebody like Al Franken, I think, so he made a little mistake and he was willing to apologize, but he was afraid too. He was pressured to resign, I think.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you, not funny, but sad that you can equate it with the McCarthy era, and I think there's a certain quality to that. But you know, your father was definitely involved, and you knew people, and you were never blacklisted, but you must have known quite a few people.
Oh, I knew many people who were blacklisted and who were destroyed by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and the surveillance, the wiretapping, all that went on, and it was terrible.
Well, you know, behavior has changed. You know, human beings are the same as they always were, but acceptable behavior or the things that people did in the 40s and 50s or that we saw on Mad Men or whatever are very different now. I mean, and so I wonder, when you looked back on your father's suicide in particular, to what degree did alcohol play a role, or just the manner in which people conducted themselves?
Well, I think in my father's case, it was, you know, many reasons. He had been blacklisted by J. Edgar Hoover. He also named names. I think he was ashamed about that, but I think he felt he had to name names in order to get his passport back. You know, when you name names in those days, very often it was just to prove your patriotism. He didn't name anybody who hadn't already been named a communist. But in terms of his suicide, I think he was in despair because my brother had committed suicide before he did. And I don't think he ever got over it. I mean, there are many. That was certainly another factor.
Yeah, a lot.
And I think alcohol and pills actually, of course, played a part.
And in the case of your brother, that's another one where people's perceptions of other people must have played a huge role, because
well, that's the story of the so-called taboo of being a homosexual or being suspected of being gay, and with my brother, and I really want, I mean, the book, The Men in My Life, he was one of the men in my life, one of the most important men. I wanted to tell the story of his persecution as a possible gay. I don't know whether he was even, when he was found with his arms around another boy at Deerfield, and the next day his friend hanged himself, and my brother was blamed and kicked out of Deerfield. And when I went up to research it years later, they denied that my brother had even been there. I mean, they really wanted to wipe that suicide out of the school's history. And it was only when I showed a picture of my brother in the yearbook did they admit that my brother had gone to the school. And when my father went up there to talk to the headmaster, he said the reason that they wanted my brother out was that his relationship with this boy had been rather unsettling to other of the boys. Well, I mean, there were a lot of boys there who turned out to be gay, and I would meet them later in my life because many of them reached out to me. But that was a case where I really wanted to tell the whole story of my brother's torment because he never got over it and, of course, did kill himself. I guess it was 4 years later.
So you were really an investigative reporter investigating your own life.
Yes, I guess I am. I must say I enjoy that aspect of it. I enjoy finding out. Writing about any book is really like solving a mystery. You're always looking for clues, and certainly this was a mystery that I wanted to solve, and I'm not sure I have totally. I mean, I even get today, and it still upsets me. After this last book came out, I had an email from a man who had been with my brother the day he committed suicide, and he told me a lot of things that I just couldn't bear to even hear. That perhaps my brother had been driven to suicide by a couple of other boys who were taunting him and saying, "No, you'd never do that," kind of thing. Once I heard that, I just thought, I can't hear anymore. I think that's probably the worst evidence, which may or may not be true.
Well, when your mother felt that your brother had been murdered,
yes,
there might have been some truth to that. I mean, maybe he was bullied.
In some way, it's possible. It's possible. Possible but not probable. The FBI did investigate, and they maintained that he did indeed kill himself. But he might have been driven to suicide by, you know, guys tormenting him or taunting him, bullying him, as it were. That's the other word was bully that this man used in his email to me. This man who's now in his 80s, who was one of my brother's classmates. I mean, this is the kind of thing that happens sometimes when you're working on a book for a long time. You get people come out of the woodwork, which is again unsettling.
Do you feel totally connected to your childhood self? I mean, is that still?
Yes, I do. Obviously, yes, I do. I do. I do. I kind of inhabit my childhood self, my young girl self. It's a comfortable one for me. I like going back to it. Not as much actually as I used to. Now that I'm getting old, you know, I'm an old person now in age. But I still, there's a young part of me that's still there.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're listening back to my 2018 interview with the late Patricia Bosworth. She was a victim of the coronavirus at age 86 on April 2nd. Are you still working with the Actors Studio?
Yeah, I was. I ran the Playwright Directors Unit for 3 years. It was very exciting. I developed a lot of plays and loved it, but I did leave when I began writing this memoir. I just couldn't do both. It's not possible to split yourself that way, so I stopped. But I'm still there. I'm still on the board, and occasionally I will produce an evening. Produced a Kazan evening recently when Kazan's Book of Letters came out. I had an evening with people reading them and other people who knew him talking about him, since he was one of my mentors. I do evenings, and I still work with young playwrights on the side. You know, it's fun. I love it.
I was talking to Lee Grant here on this show a couple of years ago.
Oh, lovely. I just saw her last week.
Oh, she's terrific. And she told me a funny story. I mean, I was asking her about Kazan, who was also one of the ones who named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee, and was, you know, many, many, many years later when the Oscars awarded him a special Oscar, many people sat on their hands and very, you know. And I asked Lee Grant if she ever patched it up with him, and she said that she did, that she became friendly with him again. And I asked her how, you know, how that happened, and she said that it was one of those situations where you see someone and you know that you know them, but you don't exactly remember where you know them from. And so she saw him and he said, hi. And she said, hi. And she was being friendly with him before she realized who it was. And by that time, it was too late to still be mad.
But, oh, God.
But what about Kazan? I mean, you knew him. What kind of a person was he?
Well, to me, he was probably one of my greatest mentors. He was full of energy, curiosity, enthusiasms. He really could psych you out. He was probably one of the greatest directors who ever lived, I think, in terms of directing actors. You know, he directed Brando and Dean and Montgomery Clift and all those, the greats. But he just had a genius for sort of getting to the heart of the matter, whether, you know, whether it was a story or a character, I don't know. But basically, he taught me how to work. He would just tell me, the secret is work. So all you have to do is just keep working, which I think is a, you know, when you hear it from somebody who's a genius, you listen.
Well, in his memoir, he sort of says that, you know, naming names for him was an easy decision, that, you know, he didn't like the communists and he felt betrayed by them.
That's right.
And he wanted to continue working, and there was no question in his mind. He didn't seem to be tormented by it or whatever. Although people also often say that On the Waterfront is kind of an apologist's film about naming names or whatever. But did he ever discuss that with you?
Well, in a way he did, yeah. I mean, not in a way, he did. What happened was when I began writing the book on my father, and I discovered, because I hadn't known that he'd named names. When I discovered that he had named names, I was shocked and ashamed, and I did not want to write about it. I was afraid to write about it. I just didn't want to reveal it. And Kazan and I were sharing this crazy, we didn't share an office, but we were in this abandoned office building on Times Square writing our books. I was on one floor, he was on another, these funny little offices, and I would go down to his office, and I would talk to him about what I was writing. By that time, we had become friends. I mean, this long period had gone by. First, I was a student, but then I finally became his friend. And anyway, I began to talk to him about my father, and I told him that I was afraid to write about my father's betrayal, my father's naming names. He said, why should you be ashamed? It isn't about you, it's about him. You've got to write it. And in a way, he gave me permission. And then he himself began to talk about how terrible it was to betray, that you can't deny that it's an awful thing. You have to accept the fact that you've done it and then go on. He was a great one for moving on, for not dwelling on the past too much. He was very tough. But what he said to me, I never forgot, that it was not about me. It was about my father. And if I want to tell the story of my father, I have to talk about his naming names. That's all. You know, and once he said that, I was able to write about it as best I could, and not let him off the hook, but by the same token, be sympathetic and understand why he'd done it. He'd done it to save his career. He'd done it to get his passport back, because the FBI had taken his passport away, and he had to go to Europe for jobs as a lawyer, and he needed his passport, and that's really the main reason he did it.
Well, so that leads me to my next question. Both of your books are pretty frank when they discuss sexuality. And I guess it's one thing to write about your own sexuality, but when you have to write about your mother's, that might be a little bit more difficult. But so is it sort of the same thing? I mean, you read your mother's diaries or writings, and so therefore you know all kinds of things that your mother probably would not want you to know. And now I know them too.
My mother gave me all her diaries before she died, and she just sort of flung them at me and said, do with them what you want. And I did indeed read them, and I found that she had had a very secret life that I knew nothing about, with lovers, only really a couple of men that she really cared deeply about, because my father was away so much and she was lonely. And I did want to write about that. She, you know, I think I got more understanding about her from reading her journals than I had before I read them. In other words, before I'd sensed that she'd probably been unfaithful to my father, but once I read the journals and I found out how unhappy she was and that she needed to be loved and supported and cared for in a sexual way, and there's nothing wrong in that. I mean, you know, it's very hard even today for women to talk openly about their sexuality, about what they want sexually. It's just still not tolerated, I don't think. And it should be. Not only be tolerated, but accepted and welcomed and understood. You know, we're sexual beings. There's nothing wrong in that. And I think my mother actually was pretty liberated for her day, you know. I think I mentioned in my memoir, one of my other kind of inspirations is Mary McCarthy, because she did believe in free love. She believed that it could be terrific to have love in your life, maybe just for one night, and then you go on and you have another much deeper love. There are just all sorts of gradations of sexuality and sensuality that are wonderful and should be glorified, but should be accepted. And they and today still we just don't talk openly enough about it, so it becomes taboo and terrible and dirty, and it isn't.
Oh well. There's also still, and always, I don't know, a controversy about abortion in America. And you speak openly about that in your memoir, too.
Yes, well, I did have an abortion. It was at a time when abortion was taboo. You never talked about it. It was against the law. You had to go to, you know, a doctor who often hurt you. And I mean, it was a dangerous, very, very dangerous kind of thing to do. And I did feel I had to have this abortion. I mean, I can go into the story if you want, but I did.
Well, it's just interesting that you were playing a nun at the time.
Well, the thing was, the day I found out that I was pregnant, I found out that I was going to, I'd won the part of Audrey Hepburn's best friend in the nun story, and I really had a choice that I had to make. I mean, whether or not I would have the abortion, which would be a sin because I am a Catholic, still am a Catholic, or whether I would have the abortion and, you know, get to do the movie. And I did choose to have the abortion. It was horrible, and indeed, well, I almost died. I had to go to Rome almost immediately. I guess it was about a week later, and the doctor had given me pills to take on the plane to keep me from hemorrhaging. And in those days, when you flew from New York to Rome, it was a very 14-15 hour flight, and the doctor said that I could hemorrhage if I didn't take the pills. And I don't know why, but I left them in the ladies' room in Paris. So by the time we started flying again, after the stopover in Paris, I was hemorrhaging. And I managed to hide this for a couple of days after we got to Rome. But again, bizarrely, Fred Zinnemann, the director, wanted all the nuns to be coached by real nuns in convents. I was sent to a convent hospital called the Salvador Mundi, which was run by nurse nuns, which made sense since I was playing a nurse nun in the movie. And I was interviewing this nun, And she sensed that I was ill. She kept saying, "Are you all right? Are you all right? I think you should rest. I don't want to have this interview anymore." And with that, she made me go back to the hotel. But before I left, she said, if you need me, just give me a call. And she wrote her name down on a piece of paper. And I got back to the hotel, and I was just pouring blood all over my legs. And it was just, I knew I was probably dying. I called her. She rushed me back to the hospital within minutes. I was on an operating table, and a doctor was sewing me up, and he turned out to be Ingrid Bergman's doctor for her twins, you know, Ingrid Bergman and Rossellini. But in any event, this guy saved my life, and so did this sister, I guess Sister Rose her name was, amazing woman. And the next thing I knew, I was rolled kind of unconscious into a private room, and the next day I was able to recover, and doctors came in and were wonderful to me, and Warner Brothers was producing the Nun Story. Never knew. The doctors never told them that I'd had an abortion. They lied, said I was suffering from a stomach ailment, so they paid all my bills. No questions were asked. And my absence from the set, as a matter of fact, didn't cause problems because the picture was delayed. So no time was lost. And I was there. I just couldn't believe it. I'd almost died. I couldn't believe this. And I lay there for a couple of days, recovering. And at one point, I think near the very end, the sister came to see me. And we talked. And I just kept saying, thank you for saving me. I'm so ashamed. And she kept saying, that is a waste of time. And I told her how guilty I felt. And she told me to go to confession. And then she said, you know, I think that God has saved you for something. There's a reason you're still alive. And then she asked me, what do you want to do with yourself? And I told her I wanted to be an actress. And then I said, but, you know, I think maybe I want to be a writer. And she said, well, you have time. And then I told her I was writing and trying to push with a novel and short stories. And she said, and how old are you? And I said, well, I'm 24. And then she told me that I had time. I had a lot of time, really. And then she told me that I should pray. And I told her I prayed. And we talked on and on. And it was just an amazing conversation. And then I asked her about what is it like to be a nun? And she said that it wasn't for everybody, even though she had wanted to be a nun from the time she was 14 years old. And I asked her what it was like, and she said that it was primarily a life of silence. And she said, so I really shouldn't be talking this way. I have to do a penance. And then she talked about that being a nun was about love and living the gospel. And then I asked her what was the hardest part, and she said it was obedience. That the religious life has to begin, you know, every day, as if it was a first. And then she, you know, left, and I couldn't believe that I was there, that I was alive, and I just thank God that I couldn't believe that, you know, was it fate, was it destiny, or was it plain luck that it put me together with Sister Rose at the Salvador Mundi Hospital. I mean, at that point, my survival, well, it just seemed like an incredible wonder, and that it really was probably one of the biggest changes in my life. That I realized I really had to grow up, discipline myself, stop screwing around, and I think it was an amazing, for me, turning point. Which is why I wrote about it, because I thought it is so paradoxical that here I was playing a nun, had an abortion, the nun saved me. The whole thing was. Seems almost unbelievable, doesn't it?
It really is. Did it affect your performance? I mean, when you look at the Nun Story, and it's on all the time.
Have you ever seen me in my one scene?
Oh yes,
I think it did. The whole thing, and Audrey Hepburn, who is again, you know, a special human being. I mean, she really was unique, remarkable, with a intense spirituality, a true goodness and purity of heart. I mean, you know, there was a woman who also, by the way, was changed irrevocably by this by being in the movie, she, you know, she decided when she, after she made the movie, she was going to change her life. You know, she became very, very close to the woman who had written the book, Catherine Holm, who was also the friend of another nun. And these two women became Audrey's intimates, and she saw them constantly for the rest of her life. And she really decided she did not want to be a movie star anymore. She never liked being a movie star. And she had always wanted to do for other people. And, of course, you know how she spent the rest of her, not the rest of her life, but within 10 years she was working with refugees and the UN, and that's how she did, you know, end her life working with refugees.
And but, she did stop making pictures for a long time.
She did. Oh, no, she really did. She, in fact, I think, she made movies for maybe 3 or 4 more years. She had another child. Or maybe she had 2 children, one by Mel Ferrer and then one by her other husband. But then she stopped, and the last 6-7 years was spent working with the UN and with refugees. But she actually wanted to do that. She always, she was very, very happy in that life. There was something very different about Audrey than there was about any other movie star I've ever met, not that I know that many.
Well, you have. You have met and seen and encountered many, many great, renowned, famous people, Marilyn Monroe, Montgomery Clift,
yes.
Whoever. Do you think there's... I'm a starstruck kind of person. I'm very interested in famous people, and I think most people are. Is there something about them when you get to know them? Is there anything different about them?
Well, I think all the greats, the true greats, like Brando and Clift and Jane Fonda too, they're originals. They're original personalities, spirits. They are unique. And Jane has led 4 different lives. She's now totally concentrating on activism, even though she has her series. Brando was this, you know, genius actor, but also it's funny, he too became an activist, you know, working with the Black Panthers, working with
the
Martin
Indians
Luther King.
Remember, he didn't
they
accept
all have
his Oscar.
they all are these two great stars, understood the power that they had as stars, that they could influence people, but hopefully in the right way, and which is why they aligned themselves with civil rights or human rights or whatever. But it's because they're just special. You just know that when you meet them. They radiate just a uniqueness. And you want to be with them. You're sort of shy about being with them because they're different. They have a different kind of they radiate something special.
They
radiate a special kind of magic. They really do.
Your father...
I
was going to say that your father was interested in that too, right? I mean, he represented Rita Hayworth, but also he was all involved with Wendell Willkie, right?
Yes, he ran Wendell Willkie's California campaign. He loved being in politics. He loved the excitement of politics and being around change and good change in the law. And he was very interested in the pursuit of justice and trying to get things for people who didn't have anything. He loved Wendell Willkie. That was, I guess that was the high point of his life, along with working with President Truman on the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry into Palestine when he went over with that group of both English and Americans that were trying to decide whether or not 100,000 Jews should be let into the Holy Land from the refugee camps. And the Great Britain didn't want them to come in and America did, and that was another very exciting, almost cataclysmic kind of thing that happened, because it did result in the Nation of Israel, but it's also resulted in what's happening today, I think. You know,
right.
This tremendous division between the two sides. But I think it was Chaim Weizmann who told my father, no matter what, neither side can ever win. That it was just, and it was a no-win situation.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're listening back to my 2018 interview with the late Patricia Bosworth. She was a victim of the coronavirus at age 86 on April 2nd. Patricia Bosworth, can you talk a bit about your father, Bartley Crum, who was an attorney, and his work with presidential candidate Wendell Willkie and Willkie's book?
Oh, One World. Oh, well, I mean, that was another thing, the One World campaign, not One World, that Willkie was really the first leader, American leader, and he did become a great leader. And oddly enough, I was just interviewing David Levering Lewis, who's about to come out with a new biography of Wendell Willkie, and I did not know that Roosevelt helped Willkie. He supported him in this amazing trip that he took around the world, which he took during in the middle of World War II in 1942-43, all over the world. I think he even supplied him with a plane or helped him get the plane that took him around.
That was after Willkie had opposed Roosevelt in.
Oh yeah, they ran against each other in the 1940 presidential election, and Willkie lost, but not by much. And Roosevelt was very, very impressed with him. They had many, many meetings. At one point, he even asked him, he had been a Democrat, then he became a Republican in order to run for office. But at one point, Roosevelt even contacted him, I think in 44, before he ran again for the fourth term, to see if maybe he would run as vice president. And of course he wouldn't. But then Roosevelt also had this crazy idea of having Willkie start a third party. None of this happened, by the way. I mean, it actually happened. It was talk back and forth. It's all very exciting and, of course, sad in a way, but it didn't happen. But maybe it shouldn't have happened. I don't know.
Oh, of course, Willkie didn't live very long. He died.
No, he died. He died in 44.
Yeah.
Died in late 44. I think he was in his 40s or late 40s. And that devastated my father. In fact, do you know that I remember my father getting the news that Willkie had died in that little house in Aptos. I remember Daddy getting the phone call. And he hung up. He said, "Wendell died." I can still see him in that room. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Interesting. And your father wrote a book also.
He wrote a book called Behind the Silken Curtain, which was about his work with Truman on this committee. It didn't pan out. I mean, a lot of it failed. A lot of the things that they wanted to do failed, but he wrote about it. And it was actually a bestseller, along with Norman Mailer's Naked and the Dead.
Well, it's a pretty good book. Not Naked and the Dead. That's a very good book. But your father's
book. Read my father's book?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, my God.
Did he write it himself? Did he have help?
He had help from Gerald Frank. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, he's a...
Gerald Frank was a writer,
yeah.
And my father did have help. He couldn't do it all by himself. It was just too much because he was also practicing law. And yeah, he did have some help on it. But I think most of it was his.
Gerald Frank wrote some biographies also.
Yes, Gerald Frank did write.
Judy Garland, I think?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And your mother wrote a novel. Your mother was a... Had a hit.
My mother wrote a novel called Strumpet Wind.
That's a great title. I haven't read that, but I'd like to.
It's a murder mystery, really. It's about a mail order bride who murdered her mail order husband, who was this kind of elderly, unpleasant man, because she was in love with his ranch hand. She had moved, you know. She'd moved into this ranch thinking it was going to be wonderful with this man that she'd never even met, who was a, you know, mail order thing. And he turned out to be very boring and uninteresting and old, and there was a sexy ranch hand nearby, and she fell in love with him and had a mad affair with him and decided to poison her husband, and did, thinking that her lover would be fine with it, but of course he wasn't. Anyway, she was put in jail. It was a big trial, and my mother went to cover the trial and wrote a book about it, fictionalized it.
But see, you said in your book that Bette Davis was interested in making a movie, but
was interested, like, for overnight.
Should have been a Barbara Stanwyck. Should have been Barbara Stanwyck. It was bad casting.
That's right. No, I know.
And then your mother, so she wrote that novel before she became involved, I don't know to what degree, with the strange man who tended your gardens in Aptos.
Well, that is, I think, for me, that's the most unbelievable story in my book. anything her little heart desires. Her, my mother fell in love with this man she called the Drifter. He had come onto the property. This is during the war where you couldn't get gardeners because there just there wasn't anybody around. And this man came onto the property and sort of sexy guy, tanned and bedraggled, but yet exuding sensuality, and insisted that he had a green thumb and he could help her make the gardens into a paradise, which indeed he did. He was this amazing gardener, and he turned that property that is now horrible-looking into an Eden with the flowering trees and the orchards and the beautiful, beautiful rose gardens. He transformed the place. And my mother fell in love with him, but felt very guilty about it, and she finally decided she shouldn't see him anymore and broke off with him, but he got very angry. It's a very complicated story. He was also not only a drifter, but I think he probably was a pederast. He may well have been bisexual. He turned out to not be a very nice man, and the police found him, I think arrested him, because he was a draft dodger as well, and put him in jail. And my father, incredibly, got him out of jail. My father knew nothing about my mother's passion for this guy.
And so it was your father.
And ended up finally getting him out of jail, and my mother didn't want him back on the property, and he stayed for a while. They had a lot of fights, and finally he ended up setting the garden on fire and leaving. And we managed to get out of the house and everything before the house didn't burn down, but the gardens all were destroyed. He burned the gardens up before he left. And then
because your father had gotten him out of prison to bring him back so that he could set fire to them.
No, it's an unbelievable story, as many of my stories in my life seem to be.
That's a movie right there, that whole thing.
I've tried to sell it as a movie, actually. Sigourney Weaver was interested for a while.
Too bad Barbara Stanwyck's not around.
Well, Barbara Stanwyck is not around. She would have been great, wouldn't she?
Yeah, she would have been. I see her in your cast as your mother. She'd be perfect.
That's true.
So, do you? You've written these two memoirs. Is there another one?
I may write something else, but I can't. I don't want to talk about it yet. But yes, I might. There's a very good possibility. I'll let you know. Seriously, I can't. I don't want to talk about it yet.
Right.
But I think I might yet draw on my past. I go by the I.B. Singer motto, the more memories you have, the more you know how you have lived. And I do have a lot more memories. The memories of this particular period in my life continue to be very rich.
When you start remembering, when you start writing, does it just come back? Do you find...
Yes.
You find you didn't know.
Yeah.
You didn't know you remembered.
Yes, it does come back. It does come back. In images, you know, memory is imagery, and I see things. I remember things. I see those gardens to this day. I see them, the gardens that are no longer there that you have seen in Aptos. But I do see. Yeah, I see everything. I love California. I miss it very, very much. I love San Francisco. There's just something about the whole state that is so physically beautiful.
If you had stayed an actress, would you have stayed a New York actress, or would you have come to Hollywood? What? Who knows?
I don't know. I never thought about that. I was glad that I acted for 10 years. It's a very interesting experience to be an actress, but it's not enough. It's too passive for me. I mean, you are always waiting for people to decide whether or not you are going to play the part. I've never thought of that, but I think maybe I would have remained on the stage. I love the stage. I didn't like acting in the movies that much, but I didn't act in that many movies, only about two or three.
And they're always there. That's the thing about the movies. Your stage performances are gone, but your movies.
No, I'm still on. My Frank Rich told me recently he'd seen me in some mystery show that I was in. That, you know, they, all those things are taped. Those old.
Well,
series,
so.
Route 66, I think he saw me, or was in for some reason.
Well, the new book is called The Men in My Life, Love and Art in 1950s Manhattan, and the author is Patricia Bosworth. Thank you so much for talking with me. And spending some time with us.
I'm so glad we were able to do this, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Patricia Bosworth. Her latest book is called The Men in My Life, A Memoir of Love and Art in 1950s Manhattan. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.